Star Wars Action News presents Republic Forces Radio Network, bringing you coverage of Star Wars, The Clone Wars. Our host will review the toys, books, comics, games, and all things related to the Clone Wars animated series. And after each new episode airs on Cartoon Network, our host will recap and review the show. And we want to hear your thoughts on The Clone Wars. Call us at 415-508-JEDI every Saturday after a new episode, and your call may be played on the air.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Republic Forces Radio Network for the conclusion of Season 4 and our Darth Maul story arc with Episode 22, Revenge. And joining me as they have on this arc are Jerry.
Hey, everybody.
Arnie.
It has been so long and my path has been so dark. I'm glad to be back in the light of Republic Forces Radio Network.
And Nathan P. Butler.
Hey, guys, I'm back, and I'd be remiss if I didn't note that Barrett will be joining us. Yes, Barrett from Republic Forces Radio Network will be joining Mark and I for Star Wars Beyond the Films this week. It's the March 21st episode.
All right, and we are once again here to discuss Revenge.
At last, we have revenge.
And at last, we kind of do. Let's go around and get everybody's feelings on this episode. And we'll once again start with Jerry.
Okay. You know, I really enjoyed this episode. Everything that I think we said or that I said last week still holds true. In fact, I think this week I saw, and I think we speculated on this a little bit last week, I saw a little out of this episode that I really thought, hey, that part should have been part of last week, and the things that I thought were the best about this week really needed to be expanded upon. But what we got, I really enjoyed. I think this was a great episode, a good way to tie up the season. I just wish it hadn't been so obvious of like, okay, we ended where we ended, and now we're just going to have to come back to this later. I wish it had been a little bit more, you know, up in the air about what was going to happen next, but we left it with, oh yeah, there's nothing settled. All these people are going to face up again, and it kind of left me with like we didn't really resolve anything, but the action, the story, everything that we saw, exactly what I wanted out of this episode.
All right, Arnie.
I thought it was good. I wish I thought it was great, but I thought it was good. And I'll get into my reasons as we go through the show.
All right, Nathan P.
You know, I think Jerry pretty much took the words right out of my mouth. When I was watching this episode, I kept thinking about the pacing of last week. I remember saying last week that one thing that it would be kind of unfortunate to see is if this week we got a really, really strong episode, which we did. Really enjoyable, cool episode. But if we looked back and said that as a two-parter, the stuff from last week should have fit before the first commercial break last week, and then a big chunk at the beginning of this should have been the end of last week. I actually think last week should have ended with Maul walking out on his two new legs and ing up at the sky like he does. And then we could have expanded the back half of this episode into a full episode, and maybe, just maybe, among other things, have seen some kind of expansion on Anakin sensing what was going on, because Asajj sensed it and we saw her, Yoda and Obi-Wan did, and we saw them. Not so much with Anakin. It's the shotgun hanging on the wall that didn't get used later on. So a great episode, but as a two-parter, it fails in the pacing arena, and this really should have been stretched, whereas last time should have been condensed. Fun, though, as it was.
See, and that's basically my feeling, is that I liked what we got, but it just all felt so rushed that I'm not really necessarily willing to say last week shouldn't have been what it was, but that maybe the week before it was not so necessary or something like that. The whole thing, I kind of feel about this last arc the way I feel about the prequel films, which is, it's not that any one piece needed to go, but wouldn't it have been great if The Phantom Menace ended where Attack of the Clones did?
I'm right there with you guys. I really enjoyed this episode. I've watched it 2 or 3 times, but there was so much. It was so fast paced. I feel like it could have been stretched out a little bit more over last week's episode. And where Nathan suggested that they stop, where right after Maul gets his legs and he has that screaming at the sky moment. That would have been perfect. That would have been perfect. What we got, so much awesomeness. There's lots of cool stuff going on there, but there was just so much all at once. And let's jump right into it. Maul and Savage are traveling back to Dathomir, still in the cargo ship that Savage stole, I guess, at Blightly, since he kind of murdered the guy who had it. And Savage is taking Maul back to Mother Talzin I'm guessing out of some desperate hope that she will be able to cure his madness, because he is raving like a loony.
And you know what? Last week I said I wasn't too happy with the choice to bring back Maul in this way. The rhyming couplets, I mean, there's no subtlety to the fact that it's Gollum, right? Before I ever read a Sam Witwer interview, I'm watching the episode and I'm like, is Maul looking for the precious? What the hell is going on here? And then I read all the interviews, and to have him still rhyming in couplets and everything this time, it was like, you know, if you're going to bring back Maul like this, I hoped it would be rectified quickly. And sure enough, in a blast of green smoke, it was. And I'm glad, because I like the post-Talzin Maul so much more than the pre-Talzin Maul.
Well, you know, the whole thing with what Witwer added here, though, was something that I have to wonder if it was scripted out to be Gollum-like or what, because it was in, apparently, one of the early versions of the script for Brothers, because that got handed off to Ryder Windham when he did that Wrath of Darth Maul book, and there is actually at least some meaning to those couplets. It's far above, we don't know where we'll fall, far above, what once was great is rendered small. And it's something that Maul, when he's training with Sidious on Mustafar, is told very early in his training. He hears it, not knowing that there's much meaning to it, and it comes back a couple of times now to show up as he's muttering in this case. So I'm not sure if it was intended for that to be part of his early training, something that Sidious said, or it was something that was just added to the script to make him babbling, and they decided to use it as part of the training. But it's been given at least some meaning other than just, let's make him seem as though he should be running around calling himself Smeagol.
Now, one thing that was commented on last week was how Darth Maul didn't really have the almost English accent that he had in the movie when he was nuts, and he still kind of didn't have it at first. But once he has his wits about him, then he kind of had the speech that we got from him in episode one.
See, I never picked up episode one as being an English accent at all. Maybe just he's well-spoken and enunciates very well, but I never got that out. When people were talking about, oh, he's got an American accent, and I was like, well, what did he have before? It's just he spoke very well, but I never got English out of it. So, but I'm with you. I think the way he was speaking, let's say, two-legged Maul did sound more appropriate, yet not English, though. So I never really followed that conversation people had with Maul's different accent.
You know, I was one of the ones who mentioned last week being a little bit concerned about it and thinking that it was a little odd. But I have to say that Witwer pulled it off. I mean, he said in his interviews, you know, that it was going to be something where it's more of an American accent because that's how he's, you know, speaking as Maul. But you would see the hints of the old episode one accent that we barely heard in it. And sure enough, here it is. I should have known better than to dismiss the idea that that could possibly work, given the fact that, you know, I mean, this is one of those characters that they would be sure to get right. You know, it's one of those ones where you wouldn't want to bring this character back and not do the voice well any more than you would perhaps want to bring in Qui-Gon Jinn and not have someone with a good voice in it. I think they've learned that lesson from Jar Jar with the guy who wasn't Ahmed Best at first.
Now let's talk about a little bit the reclaiming of Maul, or Maul finding himself after Mother Talzin lures him out of that ship with the follow the bouncing ball.
I have to ask, did the ball hypnotize him, or does he just like shiny things?
Yes.
I have to wonder if that's kind of that's the insect or the arachnid part of the spider legs taking over. He now is attracted to light.
Well, you know, it's a little bit weird, though, because, you know, this is already sort of creating sort of a little bit of a continuity question, because, again, that Wrath of Darth Maul was relatively recently released and based around some of the new Maul materials, including the script for this episode. And in that book, there is a segment in there where you see them actually on the ship. I'll get into it more in Continuity Corner, but it seems as though at least some of Maul's memory and sense of self has returned before he ever gets to the planet. And yet here, as soon as we see him, he's babbling incoherently again, and he was even able to pull out some coherent thoughts last episode. So it seems like maybe his grip on sanity, it's not so much that he's totally insane as he's vacillating back and forth, and they happen to catch him when they finally arrive, kind of huddled in the cargo bay, at the furthest downward end of that. But certainly, didn't he seem, if not in Wrath of Darth Maul, at least at the end last week, didn't he seem at least a tiny bit more coherent than he starts out this episode?
I'll agree with you. I got the oscillation bit, like he comes comes and goes, and like he's trying to hold on to his sanity, but it's sands through the hourglass, so is the brains of Armal.
Yeah, last week he did definitely seem to be have his moments where he was coherent and then his moments where he was just guano crazy. This week, at the beginning, until Mother Towson gets done with her weird neurosurgery thing, he is gone. He is loopy. And let's get into Mother Towson's quote-unquote operation. She pulls out the bad parts of Maul's brain and then weaves his new mechanical legs.
All I can say is it's just Deus Ex Machina, right? I mean, we need Maul sane. Maul was crazy. So let's bring in this all-powerful, can-do-anything character to right the situation and then disappear with absolutely no reason to be there other than we need this change to happen. So bring in the Mystic, right?
See, that's what I hated about it. She obviously had these amazing abilities to do whatever. It was far less like medical healing and more like garage repair. It's like, oh, well, I'll take this metal and this metal here and we'll just forge these ridiculous legs. But that's okay. After my spell works, they'll become like real mechanical legs. When that happened, as much as I enjoyed the episode, when that happened, I thought to myself, you know, why didn't they just make it to where she could just regenerate his natural limbs? Just give him back. I mean, sort of in the same way that she beefed up Savage Opress. Just give him new legs.
Because that would be foolish, Jerry.
Oh, sure. Because this made a lot of sense.
You know, I mean,
the way she was able to do what she did, nothing should have been beyond her.
I gotta say, I like the idea that she's pulling out the level of insanity, sort of healing him in a dark side way. Not so much going in and setting right what was wrong, so much as finding what was wrong and ripping it out. It seems like essentially a dark side version of the force healing that, you know, the EU and elsewhere seems to have played around with at least a little bit. I like that, and the fact that it almost looks as though she's pulling out literal demons, you know, in terms of what he's doing. She's exorcising the demons from the head of the guy that looks like a demon. But the whole thing about the legs, yeah, it makes sense in the sense that, yeah, they've got to do something to give him the legs, and I like the new look of the legs. I liked them the first time back in Old Wounds. But the fact that she could take these pieces of metal, and instead of it being that they come together and they look like what they are when they connect to him, instead, she's like, the energy zips down them, and all of a sudden, it's like they're being carved out of wood, and now we've got the finished version, whereas it just zips down, and the excess metal disappears. That was what kind of drew me out of it. I could buy the rest of it as extreme extensions of dark side use and that sort of thing, but it's really weird, the idea that she could carve it. I mean, if that's the case, why not give this woman a block of metal and let her carve a new double-bladed lightsaber for him out of it?
Or just carve a brand new apprentice. Just start over. Why take a broken one?
She did manage to make a weapon out of, essentially, the minerals in the ground, presumably back when we first saw Savage. So maybe this is supposed to be an extension of that. It just didn't seem like it.
My thinking was, I thought she was making the legs, but then when that whole carving thing happened, I honestly thought she was giving it a paint job because the legs were turning red and black. I'm like, oh, she made the Maul colors. It reminded me of that scene from like Iron Man when Tony Stark's photoshopping his Mark III armor. So then when the legs turned out to be plain silver, I'm like, well, all right, it's kind of closer to my Hasbro action figure. But I really liked the idea that Mother Talzin was pimping his legs.
Pimp my Sith.
She's thinking, it's like, wow, if this was just black with red leather interior,
then I'd be driving it.
Yeah.
Mother Talzin explains to Savage that Dooku attacked, but mentions that they will survive, they always do, which I thought was kind of a nice way to kind of leave Dathomir alone so that it might be able to get back on track for where it is in the EU.
If they plan on leaving it alone.
Please leave it alone, Dave. Leave it alone.
You know, I can see it. It's much better, or I guess much more easy, I would assume, much easier for them to take a planet that has all kinds of different locations on it and affect one part of the world, leaving the other one just fine to do whatever it's going to do later in the EU, much more so than when they take, say, you know, either an entire planet and stop its rotation or start its rotation, as the case may be, or they do something with a character that specifically contradicts what's been there before. I think culturally, unless it's something that affects everyone no matter where you are on the planet, like they did with the Mandalorians, it's not really that big of a thing. I've never seen any real worry out in fandom about Dathomir not getting back to where it would need to be for the EU. That's never been something that seems to have been a fear, because it's just they didn't affect every single living being on that particular planet like they did with, say, the Mandalorians.
All right, fine. I'll stop worrying then, Nathan. Now, before Maul and Savage leave Dathomir, Savage has something for Maul. And this is one thing that I didn't get. Where did Savage get half of Maul's lightsaber?
That's a good question. I had no idea, and I've yet to see an answer to that.
Okay, so I didn't miss anything in the last few episodes or the end of season 3.
Not that I recall.
Okay.
Well, let's think about this. Where did the two halves go? One half just got sliced out of his hand and just kind of fell into, I guess, that room, or fell onto the floor of that room they were at on Naboo. The other half would have been in Maul's hands when he got cut in half. So you could assume that maybe the Jedi grabbed the one half that remained in the room, in which case Savage Opress would have had to have taken it from them. And then the other half he just was led to by magic dust in a scene we never saw. Because I guess if Maul survived the shaft, then apparently the lightsaber might have still been in his hand. And or heck, maybe Savage found it in the little room he found Maul in. Maybe Maul held onto it the whole way down. I mean, those are kind of following the only two possible tracks.
I didn't understand why it had to be the same saber. I mean, I love Darth Maul's saber. I have a ton of replicas of it around. But I honestly, later this episode, we'll get to it. I found there were just too many red blades. It would have been nice if they'd pulled a Grievous and maybe Maul had ended up with a blue saber for a little bit.
You know, Arnie, you mentioned that. That would have been interesting. He did have Obi-Wan's saber clipped to his belt or side or, you know, whatever it is now. He doesn't really have a waist. So that would have been interesting for him to pull out Obi-Wan's saber to use on it. But we're getting ahead, because before any of that happens with Darth Maul and Obi-Wan, Maul and Opress have to go to Raydonia and slaughter some innocents. This was a very interesting scene. I had to go back and see the transmission again, because I couldn't believe that we just saw that in the Clone Wars. I know we've danced on that line for the past couple of seasons, and I think we're well beyond the "is this a kid's show?" But wow, that was pretty savage. Not to try to make a pun there.
Or perhaps it was Savage. You know, it was kind of weird is when they landed on that planet, both my son and I looked at each other and I was like, Josh, isn't that planet? And I was kind of tripping my words and he filled it in for me. He goes, yeah, that looks like Felucia from, he said, from Battlefront 2. That's what he knows more than the movies. But I was wondering if we were on Felucia, and apparently we're not, of course. But when it aired, I thought visually it was so similar to Felucia. Was that just me or?
I thought it was just you. I don't know that I really felt I saw enough of the planet to peg it. But yeah, I was shocked at the violence. Again, we always have this conversation, don't we? What's appropriate, what's not. But here's what's funny. I was watching this episode with my 92-year-old godmother. And she knows it's a cartoon, knows nothing about Star Wars. Just watches it and says, that's enough to give a kid nightmares.
That's weird, because I watched it with my son, who's almost 11. I didn't think twice about that, because the way it was shown, I thought it was implied. And, you know, I only watched this episode once, but I thought you saw some things, but it's not like you saw the actual severing of bodies. You just kind of saw something in a blurry hologram kind of fall to the ground. You know exactly what went on, but to me, it wasn't nearly as bad as some things perhaps I have griped about in the past, but no, I didn't get it from this one.
I'm not sure it was even the actual beheadings that were the thing that had me sitting back going, whoa, because as we were sitting there watching it, my girlfriend and I kind of turned to each other as soon as he said the slaughter of the innocent. It's like, whoa, he's not mincing any words whatsoever. And we immediately see these, you know, young humanoid characters, mostly children. And it just kind of stood out as, whoa, they've really jumped across the line here. They're not even trying to say that we're going to use some kind of euphemisms to get around how dark it's going to be. We are flat out saying we are going to start slaughtering innocent beings, not destroy, not even kill, but slaughter. mean, you don't even need to see the deaths from beheading to know what's coming. And that in of itself, I think the implication, if a kid would get it, would be what would freak him out, not the transmission itself.
I agree. I just thought, again, the way that it was just the slaughter of innocents. It wasn't even a Ganacht where it was already a bad person. This was more in line with what Asajj did to the poor bounty hunter 2 weeks ago.
I think you can get away with more with words, because I'm not sure if my son, now if my daughter who's 7 was watching it, she probably would have just glazed over the words and been so focused on the visuals. You can probably get away with more of just what you're describing versus what you're showing. So maybe I glazed over too for the same reason. Maybe I was just so interested in the visuals that I didn't actually catch those exact words. I mean, if you had asked me, Nathan, like, well, what were the words that Darth Maul used to describe it? I wouldn't have been able to recall them. It was just so, I was just in the moment visually of kind of the look on Obi-Wan's face and just knowing that, oh, okay, yeah, he's calling Obi-Wan out specifically. It's like, oh, wow, he must have just killed those people. I didn't even catch the words at that moment. So maybe what you describe with words, you can go a little further on versus what is actually shown, because that's going to stick with the kids more than just words that they, you know, may or may not be picking up.
I'd be curious to hear what people think for those who were concerned about the scene in Revenge of the Sith where Anakin ignites his lightsaber when the kids are asking, you know, what are we going to do, when he's about to kill the younglings. We don't see him kill the younglings, but the implication did cause some people to freak out a little bit and talk about how they would explain that scene when dealing with younger children seeing the film for the first time. I would wonder how this scene compared to that one would play out from the standpoint of, you know, how parents of young children looking at it would react to that, and whether those who were concerned with the Revenge of the Sith scene would be more or less concerned with this one.
Well, I can give you a little bit of an answer there. My boys both watched this episode, 15 and 7. My youngest one has not seen Revenge of the Sith in its entirety yet, and still won't for the moment because of that scene and the flaming Anakin scene. But this was non-specific enough. The wording, the slaughter of the innocent, yeah, he knows what that means, sort of, but there was enough distance and enough happened between showing the kids congregating outside the ship to Maul and Savage talking inside the ship that I don't think he pieced together necessarily that Maul was going to walk over there and murder him some kids. Whereas in episode 3, when Anakin is standing 5 feet in front of the kids and lights up his saber, yeah, you know what's going down. But those two scenes, very, very reminiscent of each other to, you know, a grown-up who can understand that. We see Darth Maul's transmission to the Jedi Council calling out Obi-Wan, and there's a large discussion about whether Obi-Wan should go alone between Mace Windu and Yoda. Yoda actually backing Obi-Wan, surprisingly enough. And I found it interesting that Yoda refers to it as Obi-Wan finishing what he started. I'm pretty sure when you cut somebody in half, you think you've finished it, not let you kind of left something hanging.
Yeah, I took that a little weird because it almost made it sound like that Obi-Wan had the vendetta to go off and kill Darth Maul when they first met. Now, of course, Obi-Wan probably had a little bit of that going on after he killed his master, but, you know, it was almost like Yoda was talking to him like he was a contract killer who failed to put someone down. It was like, well, now you got to go and finish this. It's like, really? That just did, to me, wasn't an accurate assessment of the events that played out in episode 1.
But remember that what we're seeing in episode 1, in a sense, is Obi-Wan's trials, except it's trials by combat. He doesn't go through normal Jedi trials. What finally gets him elevated from Padawan to Knight is facing off and defeating Darth Maul. So in a sense here, this has been his trial to denote his transformation up the ranks of the Jedi and in experience. So in a sense, his trial is coming back again for the next stage in perhaps his development as a Jedi. Of course, they would want him to go and finish that task that in a sense is what was part of his development to begin with. You know, like if the Force put him in that position so that that could be his trial instead of actual regular Jedi trials, the Force is now sending him back into the path of Maul again. It's Obi-Wan's duty, mission, destiny, whatever, to be the one to carry that out.
That's a great point. I actually hadn't thought of that at all. So that's actually a really, really good way of thinking about that. It'd been funny if Yoda had demoted him. It's like, oh, well, I guess you didn't finish it. You're no longer a master. Get out of my sight. You know, grow that ponytail back out. You're a Padawan again.
That would have been funny.
Damn, I just got rid of that rat tail.
It's also kind of funny that that the one person who's saying, don't go alone, it's too dangerous, is Mace Windu, who in the Tartakovsky series took on a whole, you know, planet of battle droids, pretty much.
Well, yeah, but he's a bad mother.
Shut your mouth.
There we go. So as Obi-Wan leaves, Yoda, quote unquote, cryptically. Yeah, that was about as subtle as a blow to the head. Yoda says that Obi-Wan may not be alone in this endeavor.
You know, as soon as I saw the fortune cookie, I knew where this was going. Before it ever finished, when it started quoting The Art of War, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, I'm like, okay, Ventress and Obi-Wan versus Maul and Oppress. Go. The fortune cookie was too on the nose this week. I watched no trailers for this. I knew nothing going in. The cookie, I knew what was going to happen. And sure enough, when Yoda goes, help he will have, or whatever Yoda says, I'm like, all right, Ventress. And there she is.
So is this why we needed the episode of exposition of her as a bounty hunter to show that she's that bad of a bounty hunter that when $1 million contract comes up, everybody just stands aside and she can take it?
No, but we needed that episode to push her in this direction so that it's not darkness that's always defining where she's going. You know, she's got to a point where she's shown that she can be effective outside of being what others define her as. Now she has her own future supposedly to look forward to. So, of course, now she can make the decision to be an ally to Obi-Wan rather than an adversary, and we can accept that as an audience. And I got to tell you, the end of this, or if you want to call this the end of this Asajj arc, at least for this season, and the way it plays out with those two together and their banter back and forth. I've said before that there were some episodes earlier in this season that made me think, you know, if it came down to the question of this versus the original Clone Wars continuity, if it was one or the other, I'd be okay now with this being the continuity. Thanks to this episode, I would be okay now, not just with if they did, I would actually support the idea, toss out the old Clone Wars stuff, keep this series now, because I think they're doing better with some of the characters than wound up in the comics. And I know there are going to be people out there decrying that, but the Asajj Ventress arc and the way she plays back and forth with Obi-Wan, bringing back of Maul, the way it plays in with Savage, I think they finally hit the nail on the head to what this series can be, and it may be better than what's come before, hopefully.
I agree completely with that. I liked that a lot. I think, again, I said this back during the first duology of this four-episode arc, that the things they're doing with Ventress are far more interesting than anything I've seen done in this series in the past, where basically, if you go to D&D terms, every single person was lawful good or lawful evil, weren't they? And now to get some of these people kind of riding the line where they're good when they need to be, they're bad when they need to be, I really like the depth of character a lot, and I like the interplay between them.
Yeah, that was definitely one of my favorite parts of the episode. After the way Bounty Hunter left us kind of almost rooting for Asajj, the way her character came in and the way that she talked to Savage and Maul and joked around sort of with Obi-Wan, it was really good. I enjoyed it. I'm actually looking forward to seeing what happens with these two in season five now. So we've kind of skipped ahead a little bit, but Obi-Wan arrives at Raydonia and finds the place is in flames, confronts Maul to be kind of set upon from behind by Savage, and is knocked out and captured.
And this is where I really start to feel that this episode was going a little too fast. I felt like him getting knocked out and captured was over very quick. It felt like that should have been a more drawn out battle. I think about that about most of these fights in this episode, is that they should have been a little bit longer, a little bit more suspenseful. Instead, it's just like, well, we have to get Obi-Wan captured. Let's kind of beat him up. I found it funny that they could imply death of innocence earlier, but they won't show Savage punch Obi-Wan in the face. Savage has to kind of pantomime a punch to the camera, and then Obi-Wan goes down.
I think what got me about that scene, I mean, it plays out well. I like the idea of Maul with the fire behind him and everything, but I think this is the one time that the animation kind of failed us this season, because it just didn't look right. Maul standing there with the fire behind him did not look normal to me. Whenever it was close up on his face and you could see the fire behind him, the fire worked for me. But whenever it was further out and it was just Maul standing there in full silhouette with the fire behind him, for some reason, something about that didn't feel well, I don't know if it's the physics of it or what, but it didn't feel right in the way either the fire moved or the way the light was playing. Something about that struck me as off. Cool imagery, but it just felt off when it was that long shot.
You know, one thing that was off to me, watching the preview on StarWars.com, you see Obi-Wan walking through the town, and you have that poor R5 droid or whatever he is just going repeatedly into the wall, right? And Obi-Wan just like kind of force pushes him and puts him out of his misery. At least what I saw Friday night was when Obi-Wan pushed him into it, it was actually cut off from the right edge of the screen. You couldn't see it. Like the aspect ratio of what was on TV versus what was on StarWars.com. So you could tell, and I guess maybe I knew doing very well because I'd already seen it on a different form, like with the StarWars.com. But I just thought it was kind of maybe poor in the directing or something, the choices of how the scene was cut off, that you missed that. You didn't see what exactly he did in the television broadcast. Did anybody else notice that, or was that just maybe somehow how my TV came across with direct or something?
I didn't notice that. My kids noticed that he took time to stop the droid from banging its head against the wall, but didn't check to see if the person laying 5 feet away was dead.
Well, yeah, because he can sense if a being is dead. He can't sense if a droid is okay. Yeah, that's just a platitude. I will say, though, I did find that it was kind of frustrating. Some of the places that were discussing this immediately afterwards, the whole, I don't think I've made your acquaintance. There were people saying, oh, how is it that all of a sudden he doesn't recognize Maul? Hello? It's to check and see if it's really him. Do you not get the next line where it is you? Hello? It was a test.
So Obi-Wan is captured, and right before the ship takes off, Ventress stows aboard. And inside, well, she kind of comes to his rescue. Surprise, surprise, surprise.
Nothing kind of about it. I mean, she flat out saves his neck in the whole ordeal. I mean, it was kind of frustrating that you kind of wonder what kind of revenge Darth Maul's looking for. I mean, I know he wants to just drag it out and draw it out. I mean, I think he says as much on the show, but it's just, it is one of those frustrating things like, all right, well, we've beat him around a little bit. Lay him down here and let's go discuss our plans, and I'm sure he'll be fine. Of course, they had no reason to suspect there was a stowaway looking to rescue him, but it was one of those moments you're just like, oh, well, you know, he had the perfect opportunity to waste Obi-Wan. He didn't take it, which I felt like in this entire scene, particularly when the four of them are battling, that Obi-Wan and Asajj Ventress are so outmatched, as Obi-Wan states it. I didn't like that, especially since Darth Maul's been out of action for so long, with two brand new legs that he couldn't possibly know how to control that well yet.
Well, but one thing, Maul's used to operating on rage, and he kind of goads Obi-Wan to the point where Obi-Wan's mad and can't really operate properly, which I found to be kind of interesting after all these years. Maul talking smack about Qui-Gon is able to kind of set Obi-Wan off kilter.
It's kind of what he used in episode one, though, too, right? I mean, when Obi-Wan was behind the red shield, he's doing that whole, like, shoulder pump, like, come on, come on, let me at him, come on. And he really went after him with a bunch of fury that you'd expect out of Padawan, who just watched his master get cut down. It was very much a young, not even a Jedi yet, drawing on the wrong things. Now, of course, that's not what helped him win the battle. I mean, he just ended up kind of getting smacked around a little bit. And it wasn't until he calmed himself and went with the Force and really, I think, really assessed the situation with a completely different set of eyes, was he able to conquer Darth Maul there. So I'm with you, Dan. It was a little weird that he's, you know, drawing on that. I guess it makes sense that he wouldn't be able to be victorious like that, because that's just not Obi-Wan. I mean, if Maul was fighting Anakin and tried to pull that stuff, because, you know, Anakin would have likewise had, you know, probably been reacted very strongly to the murder of Qui-Gon, Anakin would have wiped him up with the fueled rage.
I kind of like the fact that they did it this way, where they had him play off of Qui-Gon's death, because granted, it's one of the few things that Maul would be able to taunt him with, you know, because he hasn't been aware of the last 10 years and or 10 years plus of stuff that's been going on. But at the same time, you know, that is something that, you know, it's a feeling of helplessness in a sense here. You know, he's behind the energy shield. There's nothing he can do while he sees Qui-Gon get stabbed. And by the time he actually gets to his master's side, he's dying. It's the Obi-Wan equivalent of Bruce Wayne seeing his parents get killed. And you know, with Batman, if you really want to get at him at a psychological level, you hit him with something having to do with his parents. And, you know, it hits him where it's like that sense of helplessness does not go away. It gets tempered and it doesn't bother you as much, but it's still there at its root somewhere. It's a great way to go after Obi-Wan from a psychological standpoint. And the fact that Obi-Wan is able to get past it and sort of see that there's a better way than what he might have done at that point just shows his growth as a character. I think it worked well and showed us a little bit more about Obi-Wan, that there are some wounds that he has that aren't 100% healed over. He's not nearly as stoic as he tends to make himself out to be. I like the way it worked.
I don't know. It seemed too easy, didn't it? Qui-Gon's been dead for 10 years. It's not exactly a fresh wound. Yes, facing the man who did it, who hopefully you've thought was dead for a decade, maybe a little disconcerting, but I don't know that it would be so quick for Obi-Wan to forget a lifetime of teachings. It seemed a little convenient. I agree, Jerry, with what you said about in episode one. My friends and I were big into the role-playing game back then, and you could, if you were a light side force user, draw upon the dark side to roll an extra die and get some extra power behind you. And here, it just doesn't seem like part of the Obi-Wan we've ever seen in the Clone Wars to do this.
Well, we know he has some level of, you know, emotion to him that we don't always see, at least within the Clone Wars, because, you know, there's a whole thing with him and Satine. You know, if you would ask me, I would have left the Jedi Order. There's a level of complexity to him on an emotional level that we don't usually get to see, but that it seems like they've been peppering in from time to time. I think this fits in well with that.
It was interesting to see the usual calm and witty comment Obi-Wan actually, you know, being in a spot where he was very unsure of himself, and he, even though he made kind of a joke about it with Asajj about running away and learning from the best, he was at a point where he needed to retreat, and he was running with his tail between his legs. That's kind of where we leave him in Asajj, making a run for the cockpit and ejecting, and then leaving Darth Maul and Savage Opress stuck in the rest of the ship to wait for his revenge to come to fruition.
I have to say, when it comes to the banter between those two, I really like the way they played it out. It had that sort of begrudging type of acceptance of each other, a begrudging admiration that we've seen a little more often here in this series than we did even in the EU. The EU tended to make it more of just a straight up adversarial relationship. I'm glad that they didn't play on any of the darling and stuff like that. All those little comments back and forth that almost could have been taken as sort of adversarial flirtation. They didn't go that route, so it didn't feel super heavy-handed. It really felt like two people who know each other so well through having been in combat against each other that now they can work in tandem very well fighting together. Though, you know, the ending brings up that big question of, now what do they do? I mean, if we come back for next season and it just picks up with a brand new story somewhere, and all of a sudden Obi-Wan is somewhere else, Asajj is somewhere else, probably somewhere outside of this particular story, she's off doing her own thing, it leaves that question of, okay, well, what is Obi-Wan supposed to do now? Because the two of them are essentially now working together, at least briefly. And she is someone who they know is no longer in the employ of Dooku. She is essentially just a bounty hunter now, or whatever she wants to make herself into. But at the same time, from all the stuff she's done in the past, she has to be some type of war criminal at this point. Someone that definitely the Republic would want to see captured, interrogated, maybe even wind up putting on trial, put to death. I mean, this is someone who can't just be allowed to roam free from the standpoint of the way the Republic would look at it. So what is Obi-Wan supposed to do? And how does he justify whatever it is that he does, both to himself, to the Jedi Order, and to the Republic? I'd love to see the fallout from this, but I'm almost afraid that next season will launch without any answering of those questions, without any of those major issues of the way this story ends ever being addressed.
I agree. A standard TV series, meaning any but the Clone Wars, would end on this cliffhanger, leaving us dangling all summer, and the season premiere in the fall would be the continuation of this exact story and answering those questions. The way the Clone Wars handled it, where this is the continuation of a story begun 14 months ago, I just can't help but feel I'll be disappointed if, when we return in the fall, it's going to be Yoda and Mace go and fight an anonymous enemy on a planet you'll never see again.
Yeah, I mean, I'm like you, Arnie. I have the bad feeling that I'm getting a sneak peek into what the cliffhanger for season 5 is going to be, you know, the continuation of this story. And the 18 episodes that we have to go through between now and then are going to be, you know, perhaps not throwaway, but just something else.
Yeah, I'm with you guys. A normal show, I would expect to see what happens next at the beginning of season five. The way this show has been every season, pretty much, we're not going to see what happens for at least a few episodes. We may get lucky and get it in the first half of season five, but I will be enormously surprised if it is what they come back with season or episode one and two, or even episode one of season five.
And yet, wouldn't it be awesome if they could take her back into the storyline, make her more of a series regular, and have them say, you know what, you started training under a Jedi before you were captured and taken away from your home. You know what, give us all the information that you've got on the Separatists, become a willing partner for the Republic, and let's try to rehabilitate you within the Jedi Order somehow. Make her into someone who is sort of the person who has been accomplished herself, who now has to go back to being a student in a sense, and put her up side by side with Ahsoka, the one who has been training but is still young, has been training under Anakin, and the one who has to essentially give up old ways, essentially as a new trainee, if you want to call her that, alongside someone like Ahsoka, where they have to figure out a way to deal with each other than adversarial. There are so many possibilities they could do with this character, especially since it looks like they're saying, screw the way the EU has dealt with Asajj, we are doing something very different. You know, let's ignore it completely. If they do, it opens up a realm of possibilities, but I don't know if they're going to take that bold, that extreme of a direction, rather than just giving us essentially a lot of the same types of stuff we've seen so far. The potential is there, but it takes a lot of guts to use it. You know what I mean?
Wait, you don't think they'll do anything bold and surprising? You do know they just brought Darth Maul back from the dead, right?
Yes, but, you know, that was something that it's bold and surprising in the sense that it didn't affect anything and yet is really big and really cool. But I'm saying something from the standpoint of, let's shake up the status quo. He's just another enemy out there. He's just another bad guy out there. I mean, flip around the series regulars. You know, if you want to do something bold and surprising with Darth Maul that really fits the same bill as making Asajj someone who is fighting with the Jedi and having to go back through training or something and shaking up the dynamics of our main characters, fine. Have Maul replace General Grievous for a time. Have Maul wind up replacing Dooku for a time. But it's not that extreme. I mean, Maul coming back is cool, but what does it really affect? As long as he's gone by episode three, it affects little to nothing in the grand scheme of things, at least. It's the same old Maul just back whooping butt.
Can I ask one question to change topic a little bit? At this point, you say he's just another bad guy out in the universe, and that's true, but really, how bad is he? I mean, how many factions of bad guys do we need? We have the Death Watch. We have Cad Bane and the Bounty Hunters as bad guys. We have the Separatists. And now we have Maul and Savage. And really, who are they the enemies of? Just the Jedi, I guess? And for no really apparent reason? I mean, just because they were both told they will be?
You know, it's interesting. A reference was made, I believe at the beginning of this arc, how in the old X-Files show, you had your one-off individual stories that didn't really affect any of the long-term story. And then you had your stories with the Smoking Man. You knew those were the ongoing story with David Duchovny's character and his past and things. It's getting to the point where we have all these little offshoot enemies for the Jedi to face for the little one, two-episode story arcs. But then the overall story of the Clone Wars with the Separatists, that's kind of like every third episode or so. So that's kind of our Smoking Man for the Clone Wars.
Well, let me say this about the whole Maul thing. You've got the potential for him to find himself at odds, not just with the Jedi, as pretty much everybody seems to be, but perhaps even at odds with Sidious. There's a comic coming out called The Sith Hunters, and unfortunately it's just about Jedi going after Maul and Savage, and why they're saying Sith Hunters is sort of beyond me. But when I first saw that title, I thought, you know what, wouldn't it be awesome if Maul and Savage go after Dooku and Sidious? Essentially payback for him essentially being left for dead or something like that. I do think, though, that when it comes to Maul, right now he's one of those other enemies out there. It's a question of where he goes, how he develops. And Witwer has said in that same interview that I keep referring back to that there will come a point where Maul has to essentially give up on revenge being his only motivation, not only because we know that Obi-Wan survives, but because it's just not a fulfilling thing to see the same character over and over again going after the same goal. That somehow he's going to have to find a new purpose for himself. That could make an awesome change for the character. Still not something that may not affect much beyond the series itself, but could be great to see. One of these great story arcs, kind of like what Ventress has gotten. For now, though, he's essentially just, let's put another big bad guy out on the board. Not as ground-shaking as if we had, say, turned Asajj into a good guy all of a sudden, which it seems like they've leaned towards, or at least a gray person, as opposed to a black or white.
You know, one cool possibility for Maul, and I know we're getting into the lands of possibilities and what-ifs, but there's a line that Maul dropped, and we kind of skipped over this when we got ahead, but they're on Dathomir when Savage is kind of trying to catch Maul up with what all is going on in the world, and he says, Maul says that the Force field is different, unbalanced, and Savage tells him, yes, we're embroiled in the Clone Wars, and Maul says, so it happened, or something to that, or it happened without me. He knows the end. He knows the plan, is at least most of it. Darth Sidious let him in. I mean, he knew the Clone Wars was coming, so he has to kind of know what an end point is, or what a point further along would be. What if he jumps ahead and kind of meets Sidious there? That could be kind of fun. I just lost you all. Blew your minds.
I'm just trying to wrap my mind around it.
You think that maybe at some point General Grievous winds up being killed by the Gungans, and then Darth Maul gets maimed again, and actually it's not really the true Grievous that we see in Episode 3. It's actually Maul rebuilt to look as Grievous under some bizarre version of a Sith plan?
No, I would actually kind of find that cool. I just kind of think the possibilities of an interaction between Maul and Sidious. Like, is Sidious picking up on the fact that Maul's alive again, if Dooku is? And what's he thinking? Will we ever actually see that? That'd be, to me, kind of the interesting, oh, wow, I guess I need to get rid of Dooku and you can get your old job back. Or is Maul going to be like, if they did, would Maul be, hey, you're the one of the ones who left me behind. I want you dead as much as anybody else.
And my goodness, it would appear he can still use the Force when he is almost more machine than Zabrak. That has potential in the future.
I do really, really want to see Maul and Sidious meet again. I think that would be some good fun. And we could see, you know, maybe a Sidious says, no, you lost your job. You can't have it back. And they have to kind of fight without blowing Sidious's secret. That could be some fun TV.
Hey, Sidious being the reason that Maul's nowhere around Episode 3? I'm with you, Dan. That's got cool potential.
No, Season 6, he's going to have a change of heart. Him and Ahsoka run off together to have a Dewback farm.
And little bitty babies with very strange-looking heads.
Yeah, those horns would never mix well.
Oh, no, wait. Sorry, forgot which part of him is gone.
I was going to say, he's a machine from the waist down. How exactly does that work out?
You're assuming you know where Zabrak's reproductive organs are.
Oh, whoa, no. That is not a good idea for the next new essential guide to alien species. Please abstain.
All right. Did anybody have any points that they thought that we glazed over?
I just want to say I love that the writers, Katie Lucas, just poked fun at all of us from, 2 years ago, referring to him as Savage Oppress.
Oh, but yeah, that was great. Good.
All right. Now, to take us a little bit further into how things were shaken up, let's take a stroll with Nathan P. Butler down Continuity Corner.
Given how much was covered in last week's Continuity Corner, this season's final one can focus on both those things that are new to this episode and those left hanging last time that were not answered this time around. The new design for Darth Maul in his bipedal form was completed by Killian Plunkett, but it is almost identical to a similar design by Aaron McBride that appeared in the story Old Wounds in the Star Wars Visionaries comic, which is a 2005 mostly non-continuity comic that gave the concept artist from Revenge of the Sith a chance to tell unusual stories. This is in fact acknowledged on the StarWars.com episode guide. In that story, Maul arrives on Tatooine 3 years into the Empire's reign to confront Obi-Wan. He tracks down Anakin's child at the Large Moisture Farm and uses a confrontation there to draw out Obi-Wan. In the duel that follows, Maul loses an arm, then is nearly killed by Obi-Wan, who holds his deactivated lightsaber's emitter to Maul's head. But Owen Lars kills the Zabrak with a shot to the head from his rifle. They then bury the body in the Dune Sea. Many have suggested that since the only major difference in Maul's appearance in that story and in this episode is the length of his horns, then Old Wounds can now be in continuity. Frankly, that's unlikely, given that huge chunks of that rather short story would have to be rewritten or retconned to make any sense. In the comic, it's the first time Obi-Wan has encountered Maul and learned that he'd survived. In the comic, Maul survived and tracked Obi-Wan to Kamino, Geonosis, Mustafar, Polis Massa, and Mos Espa, but was always a bit too late to catch him. On Mustafar, he even came upon Anakin's burnt corpse. Yes, in the comics alternate universe, Anakin is not saved by Palpatine to become more machine than man. He's simply crispy. It's likely that the longhorns that we see on Maul in last week's Brothers in the beginning this week is a reference to his longer horns in this design that was reused, minus the horn length, from Maul this week. But it would appear to be just a reuse of that shared design, very much like how the Sith witch designs for the prequels became Mother Talzin. Still though, the design is so close that if we drop the horn length, the two would be effectively the same. Speaking of legs, we did not get an explanation this week for Maul's spider legs in Brothers. It would appear that the only explanation we'll have at present is Sam Witwer's comments that, quote, through all his grief and connection with the dark side of the Force, these spider legs made of garbage have grown out of him as a manifestation of his pain. But really, is that any stranger than how Talzin can not only draw material to Maul to become his new legs, but also craft that junk into specific shapes as if carving from wood? One wonders if this spell is a lot more painstaking than it looks, hence Talzin needing to prepare, as she said last week. We also received no indication this week of something that takes place aboard the tanker en route between Lotho Minor and Dathomir. In The Wrath of Darth Maul, the recent biographical novel about Darth Maul by Ryder Windham, who had the script for Brothers and early drafts of the Darth Plagueis novel and Restraint short story, but not the recent Endgame short story, to work with, Maul is initially distrustful of Savage, wondering if he really is his brother. In fact, that scene seems to have carried the same feeling we get when we first hear Maul refer to Savage as his brother in this episode. Moreover, aboard the ship, Savage uses the talisman to unlock some of Maul's memories in the book, helping him turn a vague memory of wanting revenge on a Jedi to being a more coherent memory of Obi-Wan and a bit more coherent thoughts overall. One wonders if that scene is still considered an in-continuity source or knocked out by the way that Maul was dealt with at the end of last week's episode and the beginning of this one. I would also note that those of us who commented that the promotional images of Maul with Savage that were seen in Insider and elsewhere had to be just photoshopped together would appear to be correct. In all those images, Maul always stood by a Savage that had all of his horns intact, whereas Savage's horn is never healed in this episode. Last week, I commented that the planet Lotho Minor might have been a purposeful play on the concept of Raxus Prime in The Force Unleashed. This week, we get what must be a phonetic reference. The Zabrak species is from Iridonia, which was where Maul was said to be from initially, though now there's some confusion in recent stories as to whether he was born on Dathomir and just happens to be of a species that was originally from Iridonia, or if he was born on Iridonia and immediately taken by his mother Kysena to Dathomir, where he rejoined the rest of the Knight Brothers. Either way, the planet in this episode, Raydonia, R-A-Y-D-O-N-I-A, not Iridonia, I-R-I-D-O-N-I-A, would seem to be a reference to Iridonia for those who are paying attention without having to actually be Iridonia. As the episode begins, we see Asajj back at the cantina in Mos Eisley on Tatooine. Interestingly, while it makes sense for Weequay to be there checking on bounties, she was originally planned to be on Florum when finding out about the bounties, and the Weequay would have been members of Hondo Onaka's gang. Of the bounties listed with Savage Opress, there are the Sentine Nim Mindbend, Rodian Omar Togs, and Trandoshan Zug Tassik. Among the other bounty hunters in the cantina are Imbo, like last week, Sugi, and Serapas. And no, that can't be Oked beside Asajj unless he came back from the dead after she skewered him a couple of weeks ago. Speaking of references, the Turtle Tanker, which still has no proper name this week, is noted on StarWars.com to have been inspired by Dave Filoni's pet turtle, Goji. As for the cast of the episode, most of the guests played multiple roles. Sam Witwer played Maul, along with a Weequay bounty hunter and another background alien voice. Clancy Brown played Savage Opress and a human bounty hunter. Semi-regular Nika Futterman played both Asajj Ventress and the Raydonian mother. Semi-regular Terrence Carson played Mace Windu and the bartender, while Tom Yoda Kane played the Balnab bounty hunter that was not Oked. In fact, only Barbara Goodson, who plays Mother Talzin, and James Arnold Taylor, Obi-Wan, did not play multiple roles. With that, Continuity Corner wraps up for the season. I hope this has been of some use in your enjoyment of Season 4.
All right, that is going to wrap it up for our discussion of Revenge, the season finale of Season 4 of Clone Wars. But don't think that we're going to leave you hanging, because we're going to have the thoughts of Jen, Barrett, and Jonathan, as well as your voicemails next week. And since we didn't have a preview for Season 5, we're all going to be left hanging together, and hopefully we will see something of it in the weeks to come, either San Diego Comic-Con, Celebration 6, but hopefully at some point this summer, we'll know.
The kind of the rough thing about getting any information at C6 is that the show will be on the air 2 weeks later, so it's a long wait. It's a long wait. Hopefully San Diego Comic-Con throws us something to look at.
I'm sure they'll have a wonderful panel about rendering flames.
I was going fire's the new water. Water so yesterday.
That's our new slogan for Public Forces Radio Network, where fire is the new water.
So I want to thank Jerry, Nathan, and Arnie for joining me on this story arc, and we will talk to you all next time.
Thanks, Dan.
Later,
bye.
Dan.
Thank you for listening to Republic Forces Radio Network. Remember, we want your thoughts on the next episode of the Clone Wars series. You can leave us a voicemail at 415-508-JEDI every week from the time the new episode airs, and voicemails received by 1 a.m. Sunday morning may be included in our next episode. You can find our reviews of previous Clone Wars episodes, as well as our summer series reviewing the classic droid cartoon series, at our website, www.republicforces.com. And be sure to listen to our other Star Wars podcast, Star Wars Action News, covering all aspects of Star Wars collecting, from figures to high-end collectibles to Star Wars Band-Aids. Republic Forces Radio Network is hosted by Jerry, Arnie, Dan, Jen, Berent, and Nathan P. Butler of StarWarsFanWorks.com. Republic Forces Radio Network, RepublicForces.com, and Star Wars Action News are not affiliated with Lucasfilm or any other official Star Wars-related company. Star Wars and all that the Star Wars universe contains are copyright and trademarked, Lucasfilm Limited, and no infringement is intended. Republic Forces Radio Network is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2012, all rights reserved.
Now, before Maul and Savage take off, Savage pulls something out. I'm going to say that a different way. Sorry, I chuckle. I love it when Nathan gets all hello on people.
My inner Neil Diamond coming out?
Yes, that's right.
Anybody else get the pun? No?
Wow.
No? Okay. I'm old.
Don't think that we're going to leave you hanging, because we're going to have the thoughts on those members who couldn't join us for this arc. And
my thoughts on those members is that I really feel bad they weren't able to join us. Or did you mean the thoughts of those members?
I'm sorry, I meant the thoughts of. At some point this summer, we'll know. And knowing is half the battle.
G.I. Joe.
Yeah, you know, a moment longer, we'd be sued.
Wow.
Guys, you know, the